Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward. Ooh, I'm messing up the order. And Peter Suderman. Hello, everybody. And Catherine, how exciting is it to be sitting in a studio with Nick Gillespie?
It is so exciting.
Yeah. You guys moved the Spider-Man, though, didn't you?
We did. Out of deference to Nick's sensibilities.
Or Peter's.
Happy Monday, and Nick, you stole my spot.
Yeah,
I'm coming back for it next week.
Next week.
As you come back from Boston, which I understand is not as wonderfully libertarianly governed, Peter.
So I have been told by some excellent and smart letters from listeners. I appreciate that.
And Crispus Attucks, right?
Too soon. Yeah. We're going to delve into the somberness, despite that cold opening, of today's headlines here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors over at Qualia Life. Friends, have you heard the one about senolytics? Senolytics is the name we give to a category of ingredients discovered over the past decade or so, which could prove to be a game changer for healthy aging and enhancing your physical prime, if that's indeed possible. For Nick Gillespie, here's how senolytics work. As we age, all of us accumulate senescent cells in our bodies. Senescent cells are the ones that cause symptoms of aging: aches and discomfort, slow workout recovery, sluggish mental and physical energy. These zombie cells are old and worn out, taking up space and nutrients from your healthy cells. Now, though, you can prune these dead cells by taking Qualia Senolytic. Qualia Senolytic is a vegan, gluten-free, non-GMO supplement, and you only need to take it twice a month to remove those zombie cells and keep them from making you feel old. To join the resistance against aging, just go to qualialife.com/roundtable and get up to 50% off. Then use the code roundtable at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's qualialife.com/roundtable, or just go to select GNC locations and look for Qualia Senolytic. By whatever means, do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. 1 year ago today, thousands of Palestinian terrorists burst through or paraglided over the militarized border between the Gaza Strip and southwestern Israel, brutally murdering around 1,200 people, including more than 30 Americans, most of them civilians, also taking nearly 200 hostages back into Gaza. It was the highest Jewish death count on a single day since World War II. And yet another bloody milestone in one of the planet's longest running conflicts. In the year since then, Israel has pushed a pulverizing war through almost all of Gaza, killing an estimated 43,000 people, although numbers are obviously very hard to come by. 100 hostages, their whereabouts still remain unknown. The Iranian-backed terrorist group Hezbollah in southern Lebanon chose October 7th to immediately open up a northern front, at least in the air, and sending rockets kind of constantly. Israel had to withdraw 100,000 of its citizens. And then over the past month, Israel has basically wiped out all of senior Hezbollah leadership, and less than senior as well, in a series of daring, crazy strikes. There's even, as we speak on this morning of October 7th, Israel's conducting airstrikes in Beirut, in populated areas, going after weapons depot. The world, including whoever is running things in the White House, remains on edge, trying to figure out what's going to happen next. Iran sent 200 plus ballistic missiles into Israel last week, and miraculously only one person died, a Gazan, from that. We don't know what's happening in the world, and there's a whole bunch of U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf and around there. Catherine, let's get reflective about this, maybe more than programmatic. We've lived through probably too many days that changed everything in our lifetimes, including most notoriously or worsely September 11th, 2001. How do you think October 7th changed things?
I think it made the thing that so many people were hoping to deny about what was happening in that region undeniable. This was never going to be a conflict that could be resolved peacefully, I don't think. And that was demonstrated over and over by your various intifadas, your various kind of flares up of violence. I think there was this idea that when it was out of the headlines in the U.S., that maybe things were getting better. Things were not getting better, it turned out. And now they have gotten almost unbelievably worse. And I think that's the place that I am after a year is we seem farther than ever from any kind of resolution. And maybe we always were this far. And so all that we've done now is sort of make the underlying hopelessness manifest.
Nick, how has this changed the way you look at things, or how do you think that it has changed the way the world should look at things 1 year later?
A couple of general thoughts. And one is I actually disagree with Catherine in terms of it, not that things are not terrible there right now and whatnot, but I actually think the October 7th attacks, which were obviously done by Hamas but were pushed and sponsored by Iran, it was a reaction to improvements in the kind of geopolitics of the region once the U.S. pulled out. And, you know, the U.S. retreat withdrawal from Iraq and broadly from the area, as much as we have been withdrawn, you know, pretty much in our lifetimes, combined with the Abraham Accords, there's actually comedy growing between, you know, Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, et cetera. And I think in the long run, I don't know about the medium run, and that might be all that matters, or the short run, but in the long run, this is actually what October 7th has helped do, is to show how Iran is the common enemy of the people who are in the Gulf and the Gulf states. It's not religious, ultimately. It is more nationalistic and imperial in a different sense of the word. And I think what you're going to see over time is the fact that, you know, countries like Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Israel have more in common than they don't. Those countries, the Arab countries, have either given actual air support or allowed the Israelis to operate in a way that is unthinkable, you know, even 20, 30, 40 years ago. So in that sense, I think I am optimistic about the possibilities in the region. In the context of the United States, the thing that I was thinking about a lot over the weekend was the immediate response among aspects of the American left that absolutely undeniably celebrated the Hamas slaughter of innocents. And that has had a major effect that I think will be felt for years to come, where it's fractured the left, where liberals went along with progressives and were kind of like, okay, yeah, we're in for a penny, we're in for a pound. What you've seen over the past year are people who would have been on the left are now pulling back from the most insane aspects of the progressive left, which is the part that is celebrating Hamas. Or, you know, rallying around Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization who first and foremost terrorizes Lebanese people, you know, and then Israelis, et cetera. So in that sense, I think that has been a clarifying moment over the past year. And then the other thing, which I think is also cause for optimism, is that the American response to all of this, or the American people, we have learned lessons from our terrible foreign policy for most of the 21st century. You do not hear people clamoring for American boots on the grounds or an involvement up to our necks in either Israel or Ukraine. There are people who, you know, think we should aid these countries, and I agree with that to most extents, but we are no longer acting as if the last 20 years of American failed military interventions and attempts to do regime change hadn't been tried and failed. So, in a weird way, a year after, and particularly just a few weeks after these incredible targeted Israeli successes in terms of, like, you know, kneecapping both Hamas, but Iran, and especially Hezbollah, you know, I think there's reasons to be optimistic.
Peter, as the World War III worry wart on this podcast, do you share Nick's optimism?
I think I'm somewhere in between Catherine and Nick, actually. I mean, we just very obviously live in a world that is more dangerous and more volatile internationally than it was a year ago or 2 years ago with the war in the Middle East and as well as in Russia, right? And in the Middle East, I think, you know, from here, I take Nick's point in some ways. You can kind of see a path to something like stability here in the medium term or the long term, where Iran's proxies are defeated. Iran itself is more or less contained and mitigated. Hamas is routed. And Israel ends up allied with other Middle Eastern powers like Egypt. Like, I think that's a very plausible outcome here. But I think you can also see a long-term path to instability as the conflict just keeps going. Maybe not at this level, but at a lower level where people never really start to feel safe again. And it never seems like, oh, we have reached some sort of peaceful equilibrium, because bitter memories linger and they end up driving policy decisions and decisions about violence and about war. And sort of to bring this back home, you know, the way I think about that is, we live in this more dangerous world now. We live in this, or at least a more volatile world. And it would be very nice if the United States had a functioning presidency. Because right now, I mean, the thing that you pointed out, sort of, at least or pointed to at the in the beginning here, Matt, was it's not at all clear who is making decisions in the White House, right? President Biden just seems so clearly out to lunch, disconnected from whatever his own administration is doing. He doesn't really seem to be a part of it. And maybe I think there's some libertarians who might argue, well, that's a good thing, because it is allowing regional actors to make their own decisions without U.S. interference, without the U.S. trying to kind of play director here. And I think maybe there is something that is good to that, good about that, except that the United States has thousands of troops in the area. The United States is not just pulling out, is not just sort of saying, well, we're not making a decision to not be part of this. It's just that Joe Biden is himself not part of this. And maybe that's better in some ways, you know, here in the short term. But if there is a real crisis, if there is a moment where you need someone to be in charge and to make a decision, the whole point of the presidency in the American constitutional system is that you don't have things run by a committee in those crisis moments. And right now, things are being run by a committee of, essentially of political appointees and top advisors rather than by the president himself. And I think that that is a dangerous and scary world to live in as an American.
I think one thing that has been laid bare by this, whether or not this is percolated down to the major political parties and their candidates for president, is that it shows the limits, illustrates the limits of America's never-ending major player character syndrome. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, wrote a piece that went to press 5 days before the October 7th massacre. I wrote it for Foreign Affairs, 7,000-word essay about all of the successes of the Biden foreign policy team. And he wrote things such as, quote, although the Middle East remains beset with perennial challenges, the region is quieter than it has been for decades. And he also bragged that we have de-escalated crises in Gaza. Whoops. That is not obviously what has happened. And we have this tendency in our dumb politics to always personalize everything. Donald Trump, when he's running for president, he will constantly say that, this bad thing wouldn't have happened under me. This could be true. We don't know. It's hard to say. But we also know that lends to his kind of great man theory of international relations, which is not great, because that invests a lot of unhealthy power into the presidency and continues the illusion of omnipotence that just doesn't exist anymore. So we should be, I think, transitioning to a world where America can't dictate outcomes. And all we have seen is this. At some point, people are going to wake up to the realization that Benjamin Netanyahu, he keeps the U.S. under advisement. But at this stage right now, it's pretty unclear. There's even reporting from today or yesterday over the weekend that the administration is thinking about like cash rewards to Israel for not hitting Iran too hard in retaliation. And if that is at all true, that kind of illustrates the rudderlessness of American foreign policy on this stuff. Like
Are they going to redirect money from FEMA?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great look.
As long as it's not going to Haitians, it's good.
are dying everywhere in this country. And also, it's just like it shows how much U.S. foreign policy under Biden has been like, just please don't escalate too hard. And then otherwise, like not really having an idea about which direction things should be going on. So we should translate that into let's stop pretending that we are omnipotent. I fear that we're not exactly there anytime soon. Catherine, maybe a quick semi-follow-up to that concept. You alluded at the beginning to like maybe this stuff was always intractable, and we had been sustaining these fictions as of October 6th that X, Y, and Z could be achieved through peaceful means. Is that a way of saying we should remove the phrase two-state solution from the U.S. diplomatic, whatever, thesaurus?
Sure.
There's a word there. I don't know what the word is.
Playbook.
From the
playbook?
Urban Dictionary as used by the
U.S.
Blob.
Diplomatic Urban Dictionary. So I think not quite that far. I would say when Joe Biden says two-state solution, all I can hear is, yeah, I don't know what to do. I think that is what that phrase means right now. I do think it's entirely possible that the way this ends is, in fact, two states of some kind in that disputed territory. But I don't think the U.S. has shown any ability to bring that about after decades of just saying that phrase reflexively every time somebody asks. And I think that my pessimism in my first answer comes from the fact that this was never a quiet time in the Middle East. This was never on the verge of being resolved. This was never, this is this stupid Jake Sullivan essay, like, oh, congrats, like, we did it. Good work, American foreign policy actors. Things are looking fine in that region. We have no idea. We have no idea what's going on. And the sooner we accept that, the better. But I don't, maybe there will be two states, but I don't think it's a solution we can give to them.
Nick, you're a big fan of
the two states are going to be confusion and frustration.
Yeah.
Nick, you're a big fan of the Abraham Accords negotiated under Trump. Barak Ravid's book about that is called Trump's Peace, and he's no fan of Trump. Question for you, though. The usual role for the U.S. in being around the Abraham Accords, and Trump was key to that, or as Jared Kushner as well,
is to sell Bibles that include both the Old Testament and the New Testament, as well as America's founding documents, Matt, for just $60 with a leatherette covering.
Lee Greenwood boldness removal yeah. Hats.
A bargain, considering yeah. that every single one of those documents is available for free.
But it's not the same when they're all in one place with a raised binding and gilt-edged page. Who doesn't want to have those in public schools in Oklahoma?
One of the holdups to Saudi Arabia and Israel coming to an overt peaceful resolution is that Saudi Arabia wants to have like these gold-plated security guarantees from the United States. They want to be a major non-NATO ally. Should we just kind of get out of that business and say, hey, look, you're going to live there no matter what. We're not. Figure it out yourselves. And maybe them realizing that there is no like extra sweetener from the U.S. will have them face the reality that they need to cohabitate with Israel sooner.
Yeah, in the shortest form possible, yes. And I think the way that you sweeten it is not with arms deals and things like that, or even security or defense guarantees, as much as trade. Saudi Arabia is trying to become more like the UAE, which doesn't have the history of chopping up people who may or may not have been journalists in Turkish embassies and things like that. So I think there's a way to do that. To go to your point, Matt, we act as if, the U.S. acts as if we are the major player in all of this, but it's clear we're not. Israel did not tell the U.S. that it was going into Lebanon the way that it did until they had started doing it, because Israel is not acting as if they have to clear anything with the United States. And the United States should start, we need to get that message. And I think recognize that we're going to do better by pulling out more than trying to, make sure that we are at the table and that everything is given, that the U.S. somehow makes things happen. That's just it hasn't been the case. It's not going to be the case. The, you know, a Middle East peace is going to come from within the countries in the Middle East, probably, you know, coalescing around a shared fear and a righteous fear of Iran, you know, as and a country like Syria, which acts in concert with Iran all the time. The sooner we get that, you know, in our heads, I think the better it'll be for everybody.
All right. We mentioned earlier, referenced earlier, Hurricane Helene. Believe it or not, there's another deadly hurricane at this moment barreling towards Tampa. It's already a Category 4, Hurricane Milton. Presumably, that's not Milton Friedman. That's Milton Berle or John Milton. I don't know. Nick, come up with a Milton for us.
Campbell.
It's already at Category 4. Category 4, supposed to come in Wednesday, even as parts of Florida and Georgia, Tennessee, and especially North Carolina continue to try to dig out of Hurricane Helene, which is the worst we've seen in this country since Katrina, with more than 200 deaths. Peter, this is your part of the world. Are you able to give us a snapshot both of like the devastation of Helene and also amid all the fog of politics? About the government response, particularly on the federal level.
So just in terms of the devastation, it's a bad scene. And there's no sugarcoating it. There's no saying, well, you know, it's not as bad as it sort of sounds like. It's a bad scene. And I guess we don't know exactly how bad. And this is part of the problem, is that in North Carolina in particular, you have a lot of low-lying floodland areas that have just been devastated by flooding, that where the waters rose up to the level of, you know, the second or third floor of a house, where cars and vehicles and cars and buildings and just everything has been taken out. And there are scenes in, you know, like the River Arts District, where I walked around just last year. That place just seems to be kind of gone. And gone in a way where you sort of wonder, will it ever come back at all in the form that it was in? And that was a district that was sort of, you know, artsy bars and also artists' workshops, things like that, right? It was just kind of interesting, you know, sort of hipstery, innovative, like low cost, like people just doing interesting stuff down there. And that whole area seems to be just, you know, completely devastated. And then around the Asheville area in North Carolina, you just have a whole lot of mountainous areas where the roads have been blocked off, or the roads, and I shouldn't say blocked off, because in many cases it's not just that they are closed by the authorities, it's that the roads kind of don't exist anymore, or they don't exist in any kind of functional state. And that means that it's very, very difficult to get in and perform rescue operations or to get aid to people. And so what we've seen is this kind of haphazard and, you know, and distributed effort by both federal and local authorities, as well as private operations, to try to get aid. And the news that is coming out of that is just maddening, because a lot of it is coming from Facebook posts of people who you don't know, sort of thing, or, you know, oh, but a friend says, I know somebody who knows this guy. So it seems like, well, is this person actually providing an accurate picture? You don't know. These are not people who have any kind of journalistic reputation. It doesn't seem like they're necessarily lying on purpose, although we know that people post things on Facebook for reasons that we don't always understand, or just that are, you know, inaccurate, because they misperceive what's going on. And so it's very, very difficult to get a kind of holistic sense, a big picture of what is actually going on. But it's a bad scene. There are a bunch of different disparate rescue efforts. There are reports that the government is blocking at least some of the private efforts, or making it more difficult, I should say, for those folks to get in. At the same time, the information that I'm hearing, again, through stuff that is not entirely verified, is that, look, in some cases, they're blocking people from getting in just because the logistics to get into some of these mountain regions where the roads are kind of non-functional, the logistics are really bad. And so they're saying, oh, you can't take a gigantic truck up this mountain, because that gigantic truck isn't going to work, right? Like, you're going to have to offload all the stuff and like put it on smaller vehicles or things like that. And so, again, it's very, very difficult to tell what's going on. It's very difficult to tell whether, you know, what the relationship is right now between local, federal, and private aid authorities and efforts is, and whether or not they're really working well together, or whether or not they're in great tension here. But it's a mess, and And it's even more of a mess because part of the mess is we don't know how to solve this problem because we don't know the exact scale and particulars of the problem, just because like getting in and seeing getting information out of the zones that have been destroyed is so difficult.
Catherine, what are some perhaps perennial reason / libertarian lessons about public policy and disaster response or preparedness even? And are any of those lessons not annoying?
I regret to inform you that all libertarian lessons are annoying. And so here we are. This is just our bed and we made it. So there's a couple things that are going on. One is, you know, unfortunately, it's become a kind of extremely partisan coded critique at the moment to say that FEMA kind of sucks. It's bouncing around in weird ways in the presidential election. That should not distract us from the fact that FEMA kind of sucks. FEMA is really very bad. And Hurricane Katrina was an incredible demonstration of that. But so have many disasters since been an incredible demonstration of that. It is not a well-run bureaucracy. It is inefficient in its absolute best form and obstructionist in its worst. The sort of discourse around money going to immigrants versus money going to Americans who are affected by Helene has been just incredibly stupid. And we can talk about that real quick if we want to. But just first and foremost, like, don't trust the feds to save you when you need saving is now and always the lesson.
Talk about that then. Haitians. Yeah.
Okay, so here's what's going on. We have Donald Trump, as usual, helpfully just like throwing sort of a smattering of untrue things into the discourse. In this case, the allegation is that money that was allocated for disaster relief has gone instead to programs that house immigrants. Now, first of all, we're just to get the scale. The program that gives block grants to state and local governments to house immigrants, that's a $650 million program. It's separately appropriated. That money exists in a box for that purpose. That's compared with $35 billion for disaster relief. So even if that money was being borrowed from the disaster relief fund, it still would not be a substantial portion of it. However, it's not. It's a totally separate fund. The folks at FEMA have said they have plenty of money to handle Hurricane Helene. They're a little worried if Milton hits right on its tail that they might need more money. Of course, that's what people from FEMA say when they go in front of Congress. The only thing they're ever going to say is we need more money. So, you know, I think we should take that with a grain of salt. And if they do need more money, we have an emergency appropriations process for that. Again, totally unrelated to housing migrants. Now, somebody did raid the disaster fund to deal with our immigration issues. That was Donald Trump during his presidency, who took money illegally out of the, not quite illegally.
Improperly.
Improperly. It was not illegal. He is allowed to do it. He gave notice. Improperly out of a unrelated monies and put them into border enforcement. So as usual, accusations against Democrats are very much like I'm rubber and you're glue type situation.
Nick. Also of note, that $650 million fund for immigration, for immigrants that Catherine mentioned, that money is appropriated by Congress. It was Congress that decided that that money would be spent that way, not FEMA, not the executive branch. And as a result, the executive branch does not have the capability, is not allowed to spend it some other way. And so if you are mad that that money is being spent that way, blame Congress.
Nick, so FEMA is annoying and Donald Trump is annoying. Just to keep the triple hater vibe going on forever, am I
Why
wrong?
Why only three?
Yeah,
it's
true.
You can have as many hates as you want, Nick.
Yeah.
Am I wrong at being annoyed at the media, including in the vice presidential debate, which we'll talk about later, pivoting immediately in the first sentence of, oh, Hurricane Helene, a lot of people suffering, policy, yeah, okay, you have my attention, climate change. You know, do you believe in climate change or not? And in a lot of the media reports are like that. Is that just me being skin deep, annoyed, and myopic, and that maybe that's what we should be talking about, or am I totally right about everything?
Yeah, I think you, I hate to admit that you're probably totally right about everything, Matt. And one of the other things to think about with the media this time around is they're definitely, I think, softballing the FEMA response, the badness of it, and whether or not it reflects poorly on the current administration. Katrina, you know, FEMA did not act well. The federal government did not act well during Katrina, and it reflected very poorly on George W. Bush, as it should have. You know, the state and local governments also acted pretty poorly in those cases, in those particular cases as well. But this time, it just doesn't seem to be percolating up to, you know, the person who's been running FEMA, you know, for the past, you know, Biden and his administration. I think, you know, there were on the 10-year anniversary of Katrina, there were a bunch of reports that came out, all of which said that FEMA had gotten a little bit better. It had gotten a lot more money, and it had gotten a ton more administrators and things like that, but it hadn't really confronted how it does stuff. One of the lingering questions here, and it's really hard to know, you know, as I think other people were saying, a bunch of the information that comes out of this is all bullshit, where it's like, oh, well, I don't know, but my cousin told my brother who had a friend where this happened, you know, and you know, it's just unreliable. But consistently in natural disasters, groups, both nonprofit as well as state, as well as private or, you know, government and private groups that are closer to the situation and better information, and they tend to act better. And I was going through a one of those 10-year kind of look backs at Katrina by Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. And he had written a pretty extensive report about how when you looked at what worked in Katrina, it was almost always groups of people who were closer to the event had the best information and also the best ways of dealing with stuff. And that is something that's worth keeping in mind here, which is that when you expect a distant, you know, a distant overlord to protect you and to defend you and to help you out, it's not going to end well. The other thing that's worth thinking about, especially if the next hurricane is Milton, you know, is named after Milton Friedman, there's a lot of, you know, on the edges, we need to start thinking about how do you stop subsidizing people to live in coasts that get hurricanes all the time or extreme weather events, but also in areas, as Peter was talking about, you know, there it has taken forever, and we're not even there yet, in the Mississippi River, to stop subsidizing people living in floodplains and then rebuilding after disasters happen and things like that. This is the type of stuff that almost never happens. But to actually take seriously the signals that markets deliver about where is a good place to live versus where is not, that would be extremely helpful. Matt, I know you have sat through a lifetime of stories about rainstorms and mudslides and wildfires in Southern California, where, you know, you only would hear from Red Buttons or Dick Clark every 5 years when their house in the middle of nowhere, which should never have been built, but gets built and rebuilt and subsidized by tax dollars, you know, they're suddenly trapped and we need to, you know, have convicts parachute in and save Red Buttons or something like that. And I realize Peter and Catherine have no idea who we're talking about. Matt, you may not even remember.
Suzanne Red Summers Buttons, but, is the go-to example, yeah. I think. I do remember,
but it's just like, you know, this isn't about climate change. It is about policies that have been in place for the past 100 years that ultimately end up subsidizing really bad decisions on the part of many people.
I would invite anyone who's thinking about making a politics about this or sharing very kind of partisan edged information about this particular hurricane response to pause and go and look at Hurricane Katrina, maybe even revisit one's own comments at the time and note that maybe all teams have or all parties have switched teams. Like Kanye West is probably going to say that Joe Biden hates white people or something. And in this one, like the approach towards FEMA.
But what will Mike Myers say?
That is the eternal question. Yeah, what kind of face curdling will he have to accept?
Yeah, he prefigured Tim Walz as Kanye West was denouncing George Bush for not caring about black people, Mike Myers was just kind of sprouting a new face.
Yes. All of which is to say, people who are on the ground, as Nick alluded to, are not only doing better, but they're being less political. And maybe there's a lesson for all of us who aren't there. All right. We're going to get to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor over at the University of Chicago. Hello, Milton Friedman. Friends, in an election year, it is too easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion. Understanding the real-life impact of political events can be a challenge in these even-numbered years. So have we got a podcast for you. It is called Not Another Politics Podcast, brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Not Another Politics Podcast provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you acquire your podcast. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Joel. Hello, he says. I am a non-party classic/historic liberal. I like historic liberal. And I enjoy your podcast. I also lived in Kiev, Ukraine, from 2012 to 2014. I am generally anti-interventionist. Why is it that when I hear the Russian war against Ukraine discussed by libertarians and other anti-interventionists, I've never heard mention of the Budapest Memorandum, documents signed in the early 1990s between Ukraine and the US, Britain, France, and Russia, where the signatory nations pledged to defend Ukraine's territorial sovereignty in exchange for Ukraine giving up their significant nuclear weapons from the Soviet arsenal in Ukraine's territory? My understanding is that the Budapest memos didn't specify with any precision the responsibilities of the signatory nation in the case of aggression against Ukraine, but wouldn't that history at least suggest a moral case for strong U.S. involvement? Maybe it shouldn't be tax dollar funded. Maybe our political leaders should remind us of our historical commitment and call for private actors to support Ukraine. I'm not a diplomat or political scientist, so I don't know what should be done. However, I would love for this historical aspect of our involvement to get some airtime in our cultural debates about what our duties ought to be towards Ukraine. Joel, thank you for that. I will take first answer to this. We've almost certainly mentioned it on this podcast, and I know I've written about it, as has J.D. Tuchilli, on multiple occasions. And you are right to point out to this important, at the time, groundbreaking 1994 piece of diplomacy and its relevance to Russia's initial invasion of and takeover of Crimea in 2014, which is the big thing that violated that. The way to think about the Budapest Memorandum, which is not a treaty, right? The U.S. decided, Bill Clinton administration judged, and I think accurately, that the U.S. Senate would not be in the mood to ratify a treaty and to create this enforcement teeth in it. The main signatories were the U.S., Britain, and Russia, in addition to Ukraine. And then France and China were kind of did lesser documents. And it was for Ukraine as well as Belarus and I believe Kazakhstan to do similar kind of things. And Russia and everybody else was supposed to respect the territorial sovereignty and to not invade these countries that signed it. And the reason why this was held up, the twofold reason as a model of diplomacy, was that it had nothing to do with expanding NATO. Like, this is a George Kennan-tastic, the guy who helped create originally the kind of coalition of the Cold War in the late 1940s, but then became a huge critic of the expansion of NATO in the 90s. He loved the Budapest Memorandum, and understandably so, because it was a way to create some amount of security guarantees, independence, latitude, while also reducing the threat of nuclear war. Sounds like a win-win. And now we see how it is not. And it is, if anything, become a lesson in why any country should never give up its nuclear arsenal, whether you are Libya or Ukraine, that people will not necessarily respect that. Russia's theory of the case is that as soon as there was the Maidan revolution in Ukraine, then they kind of stopped being a relevant signatory to it. And can we please change the subject as fast as we can, kind of thing. The memorandum also kind of devolved and said the UN Security Council will be the main tool of enforcement, which now kind of reads like a laugh line, but it was 1994. And keep in mind, the Security Council was very much involved in the Gulf War, a coalition of nations that came together under U.S. leadership and Russia's blessing, too, I might add, or Soviet Union's blessing, to thwart the territorial incursion into Kuwait by Iraq. So, like, it seemed more plausible then. It doesn't seem plausible now. And it's sort of a signpost that, you know, a security guarantee without an actual security guarantee is no guarantee of security. And that's the end of that memo. If anyone has anything else to add, please do. If not, I can move along.
I actually really like the just the passing suggestion that we could perhaps rely on private actors here. Just want to give a shout out to the long wished for and utterly unrealized like French Foreign Legion / Blackwater approach to American involvement in the world, which continues to appeal to me and exactly no one else.
You know, the U.S., though, has given over $60 billion in military assistance to Ukraine since Russia invaded. So it's not like we've been absent. I'm actually nervous about a lot of that because we don't have an actual security agreement with Ukraine. And, you know, we know that a lot of that money will have never made it anywhere close to, you know, the battlefield or anything like that. For me, one of the things reading that letter, it reminded me if the American left's response to the invasion or, you know, the Hamas terrorists was, you know, just horrifying and awful and morally bankrupt. Many in the libertarian world, the way that they very quickly morph from being like, hey, you know what, America shouldn't be involved to this, to Ukraine is run by a Jewish Nazi president, and, you know, we welcome Putin's defense of Western civilization and that kind of thing, that left me, like, really on my heels. I was stunned to see the vociferousness with which a lot of people who call themselves libertarian or libertarian adjacent seem to, you know, immediately believe the idea that this was a defensive war on the part of Putin, or that somehow Russia has a moral high ground here, which is not to minimize any U.S. chicanery and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, there is a lot of moral confusion in international politics. And I think that's partly, you know, that is one of the great legacies of the Bush administration, along with being, you know, the worst FEMA, you know, administration in history. We have not, you know, since the Cold War ended, we have not generated a useful, pragmatic, and peace-enhancing foreign policy. And it's really, you know, the clock is ticking on that. We can always start that conversation somehow or that move to do something like that, but we continue to just not really rise to that task.
I would just add that for those vast majority of people listening to this podcast who are opposed to NATO expansion, even from the beginning after the end of the Cold War, two points. One is that Russia was intervening militarily in Abkhazia and Georgia, in Moldova, Transnistria in 1992 and 1993. So predating even the Budapest Memorandum to all of that. And two, one would need, I think, to come up with a theory of the case in the absence of NATO expansion. What do smaller countries that live in between superpowers that have historically trod on them, what are they supposed to do? And not everyone has every answer to the world, but it's something to think about from their point of view and why they might be seeking guarantees of whatever stripe, regardless of what one thinks, whether the U.S. should be involved. All right, let's get to the vice presidential debate. Last week, there was one, believe it or not. It was unexpectedly cordial, almost like genial at times, with J.D. Vance and Tim Walz discussing actual policies on occasion. And it was also for many of us just unbearably statist. So let's go around the table and each of us come up with one aspect of how there was some kind of bipartisan anti-libertarian awfulness in this debate. Peter, why don't you start?
So one of the good developments in policy over the past 5 or 10 years on both the left and right has been the YIMBY movement, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. And this is a sort of, this is the starting place for the abundance agenda, which is an idea that in fact, what we need to do is remove regulatory barriers and other types of constraints to building in particular, but also for energy, for all of these types of policies, right? It, and so you've seen on because this movement started on what I would say is the center left, in particular with younger urban professionals, but also because it is deregulatory, you've seen this kind of interesting cross-partisan adoption of kind of YIMBY-ish abundance agenda ideas, even if in many cases, imperfectly. And so, of course, this surrounds, like the big thing that this surrounds is housing, right? That's the focus of this movement because, in fact, there's a giant housing shortage in the United States, and housing is very expensive, especially in urban areas that are great economic centers, San Francisco, New York, Washington, D.C., places like that. Housing is very expensive, but also out in the heartland in places like Ohio and places like Minnesota, housing has become much more expensive as well. And so this came up at the debate, and you had this great agreement between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz that housing, we need more of it, and it should be, it's important, but it shouldn't be a commodity. Now, I know Catherine really hates dictionary definitions in posts, especially as leads, but just kind of anywhere in Reason.com writing. But Christian Britschke noticed this and wrote about it, and he looked up the definition of commodity in the dictionary. And it turns out, you know what it is? It's something that you buy and you sell. And what Tim Walz and J.D. Vance both agreed was maybe housing shouldn't be something that you buy and you sell because it's special, because it's meaningful. And of course, yes, of course, everybody is like their home is very important to them, except for Catherine, who just like rents places for 6 months and then moves out like every it's I have no idea how she manages to do this. It's because she's a heartless robot. But for the rest of us, we really care about our houses. But there's this idea that because housing is special somehow, because there's some sort of emotional attachment to it, and it's essential to like having anything like a normal life, that we should treat it differently, that we should treat it as something like a non-market good. And so what you had was this joint agreement between Vance and Walz that housing should not be a commodity. And what that in many ways cashed out to was a sort of like gesture at YIMBYism, at yes in my backyard, except if you're an immigrant, or you're a big corporation. We definitely don't want immigration, and we definitely don't want big corporations owning a bunch of houses, when in fact, it turns out that immigrants, in part because of the labor supply issues and big corporate ownership, tend to bring down the cost of housing. It's just a terrible agreement here from both of them, where you see this kind of Midwestern statism. They're just like, oh, you know, housing is so important that we can't treat it like a normal good. And when you don't treat it like a normal market good, then what happens is you have a lot less of it and it's a lot more expensive.
Well done, Nick Gillespie. What was a bipartisan statism that made your milk curdle?
Neither of them were willing to address or even pretend that they were going to cut spending on anything. Usually you could get, you know, even the vice presidential candidates in a presidential debate or a campaign say, hey, you know what, we're going to cut this or that. And you just didn't see that. When they were asked questions about debt and deficits, they immediately went to talking about things that were completely unrelated or talking about how, you know, taxing more people will help shrink deficits, maybe, but it's not going to address the top line, or we're going to grow our way out of this. And there is just simply no way to do any of that. And so we have been on a bender, you know, a spending bender for decades now. It really kicked into high gear. I realize, you know, I'm talking a lot about George W. Bush because I just invested. I bought several hundred thousand dollars worth of his paintings. So I want to bring him back into the public conversation. But, you know, we have, like, this whole century, it's just been spend, baby, spend. And that is not a good way forward. Milton Friedman, also a popular topic today, you know, talked about how the full extent of the government in your life is really the spending that the government does, because eventually it's got to, you know, it's got to pay that tune. And, you know, we're just, you know, what happened, even Mitt Romney famously would say, I'm going to cut government spending, but then he wouldn't identify anything he was actually going to cut. But now we don't even pretend that we're going to cut spending. And to me, that was a kind of tandem thing where these guys were holding hands in all the wrong ways.
This is actually a great exchange that I want to read from because it was so blatant and like, nope, not going to answer that question. So the one to Tim Walz is, the Wharton School says your proposals will increase the nation's deficit by $1.2 trillion. How would you pay for that without ballooning the deficit? This is the verbatim answer. Yeah, thank you. And Kamala Harris and I do believe in the middle class because that's where we come from. We both grew up in that. We understand. And then blah, blah, blah.
He did everything but talk about his DUI. It's like, hey, can we talk about my DUI, please?
I'm just a knucklehead. Who doesn't go 92 in a 45 drunk and then lie about it? Same moderator to J.D. Vance. The Wharton School has done an analysis. The Trump plan, it says, it would increase the nation's deficit by $5.8 trillion. How do you pay for all that without ballooning the deficit? Well, first of all, you're going to hear a lot from Tim Walz this evening, and you just heard it in the answer, a lot of what Kamala Harris proposes to do. And some of it, I'll be honest with you, even sounds pretty, it just, nope, not even the little tiny little hint in that direction. It was awful. Catherine, what did you hear that was super statusy?
So I want to take a kind of half and half answer, which is absolutely a bipartisan convergence that I really didn't expect. Maybe I just haven't been paying enough attention to this policy area. Both of them are now like yes and energy. They use the same rhetoric. So this is to say that we had the Democratic vice presidential candidate boasting about incredibly high oil and gas production during the Biden administration. This is not something you would necessarily have heard before. You would have heard boasting about solar panels or, clean energy, this kind of thing. But he was just like, yeah, man, we are just like really getting those dead dinosaurs out of the ground and into your cars. You're welcome. And it was like, what's happening? But both of them ended up saying the same thing, which was like, we need to produce energy here at home. It should be all forms. We should be doing green energy. We should be doing oil and gas. Walz has both been kind of a big climate change guy and has voted in favor of pipelines, in favor of, extracting from U.S. waters. Like he is not easy to pigeonhole. I think the issue here, though, is that they agree it's okay, let's produce all types of energy here at home, but they really mean their kind, and they're going to subsidize that kind. And so in that sense, it is statist all around. You know, the Democrats are still going to just like dump as much money as they can into solar and wind and whatever else. The Republicans are still just delighted to subsidize oil companies as much as they possibly can. And I didn't hear one single person being like, hey, maybe we could just let Americans buy their energy from the cheapest source in a free market. Absolutely not. Meanwhile, Grandpa Joe is out here just casually wrecking the energy markets a couple days ago by being like, oh, yeah, I don't know. Maybe Israel might bomb the Iranian oil production. If that happens, we'll talk about it. And it was just like the markets lost their minds because he has no idea what's going on, I guess.
My example is more of the way they both vigorously nodded and said, uh-huh, and then elaborated on a typically statist moderator question, which began with, there's a child care crisis in this country. It's like, here's what we're going to do about the child care. This is what the federal government should do about the child care crisis in this country. And I just realized I'm
literally
just
the federal department of your mom.
Wow. That hits different with J.D. Vance, too. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
So I am, I read John B. Judas's and Rui Teixeira's Where Have All the Democrats Gone?, which is a scathing attack on the current Democratic Party by guys who in the early 21st century wrote a book about the coming Democratic supermajority. They look at how the Democrats, by their lights, have completely abandoned the working class, which is roughly analogous to people who don't have college degrees, and how that has really hurt the ability of the Democratic Party to get and maintain governing majorities. I am going to be talking with Rui Teixeira, who's now at AEI of all places, with and Patrick Ruffini, who's a Republican pollster at Echelon Insights, who wrote a book called Party of the People, which is about how the Republican Party has kind of lost college-educated people and is moving into more and more concert with non-college-educated people of all races and ethnicities. So it's an interesting convergence to you know, look at the Teixeira book and Judas book. You know, we're in a moment where both parties are declining in terms of their ability to deliver votes on a regular basis and to maintain governing majorities. And there seems to be, you know, recognition about that shift, which is that the Republicans are becoming more attuned to populist appeals to working class or non-college educated Americans. And, you know, I'm extremely, it's a great read, and their policy prescriptions, Judas and Teixeira, are terrible because they tend to come from a kind of you know, late 20th century Democratic Party of like what we really need is to build everything around big labor. But the analysis of how the Democratic Party has shifted away from the consensus that brought it to a lot of, you know, governing majorities for long periods of time after World War II is really fascinating and strikes me as mostly on point. And, you know, it'll be fascinating to see how all this plays out in this current election.
Peter, what did you consume?
I watched Joker, Folie à Deux, the second one. Did I say that wrong? That was my best Pepe Le Pew accent. Actually, I could probably do a better one, but we'll save that for another episode. It's the sequel to Joker, and it's a musical, and it's miserable. And it's not just miserable because it's a musical, although the musical aspect of it does help with the misery, because the songs are just listless and awful, and Joaquin Phoenix cannot sing to save his life. And in fact, he kind of has to sing to save his life, because what this movie is somehow it's a courtroom drama also, in addition to a musical. This is it's a Joker movie that has absolutely nothing that you would expect or want from a Joker movie, even less than the first one, which was a little bit of a sort of a turn, but was fundamentally a sort of a twisted origin story for the character. I didn't love it, but at least I thought there was some verve there. There was something really, it was kind of trying to prod people in a particular direction. It was nicely crafted. There were some really great images, and especially the way the images and the music sort of worked together in the first one. So it wasn't a great movie, but there was at least something there. And this movie is just an effort to kick the viewers in the head and punch them in the face and say, you idiots, you didn't understand the first one. So let's go over it again. And it is a 2.5 hour recap of the first film. So he talks with his lawyer about the stuff he did in his first in the first film. And then he talks with a journalist about the stuff he did in the first film. And then he goes to court in the middle of the movie and he goes over again all the things that he did in the first film. And it just reminds you over and over again that, you know what? The Joker is bad. And you people who thought this was cool, who enjoyed this, oh, you're awful. You idiots, you fans, I hate you. This is a movie that actively hates everyone who enjoyed the first film that made $1 billion and got all of the principal players gigantic paydays and the opportunity to make this movie. I hated it so much. It is maybe not the worst thing I've seen this year, because I have seen Madame Web, which might be the actual worst movie I've ever seen in a movie theater, but it is the most off-putting movie I've ever seen, or that I should say that I've seen this year. It is the movie that is most relentless in its bid to simply refuse to give any kind of pleasure or enjoyment to its audience. In fact, it hates them. Well, guess what? The critics and the audience in this case hate you back. This movie has the worst cinema score, which is a sort of an industry guide. It's a survey of viewers for movies. The worst cinema score of any superhero movie ever, I believe. So good job, guys. Wow. You hate your audience, and your audience
even
hates
worse
you
than Black
right
Adam.
Back. I believe so. Yes, I wow. believe this is the first major superhero movie to be ranked like a D or a D minus.
I got to admit that half of that description made me go, "Huh? Okay. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Catherine,
what... It sounds interesting. It's not. It is a slog. It is just joyless and miserable.
Catherine, what did you not consume?
I read a bunch of lady novels this last couple weeks and can't even talk about them on this podcast because I know who our listeners are and y'all don't care. And also they weren't really good enough to talk about. So instead, I'm going to talk about something that has brought me a lot of joy and happiness that is the opposite of a musical miserable slug. And that is Eric Bame's podcast, For Reason, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. It's so good, y'all. This podcast is just a delight. This is the second season, and it's full of terrible news. So in that sense, it is not fun. But last week's episode was just about why I cannot Zoom with a doctor in another state and get my healthcare provided. And that is a question that we have all wondered and we have all raged at. And Eric has some answers for us and also some lawsuits that might fix that. But my favorite episode of the ones that have been released so far is the case of the 17,000 missing kidneys. Nick, I know that you're disappointed that it was not called the curious case of the 17,000.
The strange case.
The strange case.
Of Dr. Liver.
Of Dr. Liver and the missing kidneys. I follow the organ donation, organ sales discourse fairly closely, and there was still a lot for me to learn and be outraged about in this episode, especially about the regional monopolies in organ donor matching, which are just utterly unconscionable, just really very upsetting. So if you have not had a chance to listen to this limited series podcast yet, I strongly recommend that you do. It's Eric Bame's Why We Can't Have Nice Things.
Yeah, the organ thing, like there are stories he tells of where people leave like igloo coolers with kidneys at the airport.
Just like
they go through security and then they forget to go to the luggage pickup or something.
It's really, it would be funny if it weren't actual life and death.
So I went to finally, after a decade of hearing about it and being up and around the region with some frequency, I finally visited the Storm King Art Center up in upstate New York on the left side of the Hudson River, about an hour north of New York City. It's 500 acres of gigantor sculptures. It's mostly like manicured, semi-manicured wildlife and lawns and trees and little brooks and pathways and walk around. And then a 5 trillion ton Richard Serra piece of iron, Alexander Calder, Maya Lin, other people. It's your eyes can't really truly fathom it. It is so cool. Go there, bring a picnic basket with Boo Boo Bear and just stroll around. It's particularly nice right now because it's the fall and there's lots of foliage things happening and it's not yet too cold to enjoy it. You will feel like you are in a Pink Floyd video that doesn't exist. Just huge ironwork, man-made things against this backdrop really just kind of like stuns you into slow silence. And I'm sure with repeat visits, all kinds of new things open up or don't, and just a nice place to walk and spend the day. Storm King Arts Center, can't go wrong. The people were right. I just didn't listen to them for a really long time. I'm here to say that you were right. It's really cool to go to. Bring a kid and a blanket. Okay.
Did you have a favorite piece, Matt Welch?
I would say no. Maybe I don't know which one it exactly was. I don't think it was Richard Serra, but it might have been. So I wasn't focused on the individual artist, Nick. I was more about the largeness of things. But it's a kind of a gigantic iron, looks like the kind of letter A, but with some stuff on it. Look on my Instagram, you can see a picture of my daughter standing in front of it, and it's ridiculous. And it's sort of perched at the top of a low hill in the middle of a pretty cleared out field. And it's just, you cannot process the information that your eyes are telling you. So that was probably my favorite. I'm not sure. But anyways, that's all the unsureness we have time for. You already heard about one podcast. The other good ones you can all find at reason.com/podcasts. Speaking of which, Nick, are there any events in New York City you care to popularize here at the end of hours?
Yeah, sure. There's the Soho Forum on October 21st with David Leonhardt and John Early talking about the American dream. There's a Reason Speakeasy, which is a live taping of my interview podcast with Musa Al-Gharbi on October 24th. And there may or may not be any tickets left to the Reason Roundtable live taping at the Comedy Cellars Village Underground on November 4th. If we're sold out, I think there's a wait list. And, you know, sometimes because of satanic spells, people get sick or can't make it. So maybe the wait list will open up if, in fact, all tickets are sold. But those are all coming up. You can find that at reason.com/events.
And if you're waitlisted and somehow get bounced, you're right next to all the comedy. So just go to one of the comedies clubs right around there. It's a great part of New York City. A fun time will be had by all. All right. Thank you for listening. Catch us next week here in the same Bat channel or Joker channel or whatever. And goodbye. What's your